This morning our text is in the book of Matthew. We'll be in the 19th and the 20th chapters. As you're turning there, what I'd like to do is maybe just comment on a little bit of family stuff here for a second. We're all sort of learning new ways of being a church family here. The ways we're learning impact us in lots of areas. For example, let me just tell you right now, we're still doing some tweaking within this room on even the sound. And we recognize that those of you, and boy, I hate to say this, this is really painful for me to say, but those of you who sat in the first four or five rows, you are missing a speaker that helps you. So those in the first four or five rows, if you come down here so you can hear better, that's actually are the four worst rows possible. Never hear me say it's better in the back, but today I got to say it's better in the back. They're going to put some speakers in here at some point in time. Don't know what the timeline on that is that will help the first four rows, but that's just one of the tweaking kinds of things that are occurring. Yeah, I know. What did I say? I know. We're learning new stuff. We also want you to know that this parking lot to the south, that parking lot has always just been kind of open, free game. Whoever got here, that parking lot was for. Well, I have to tell you, we're taking that parking lot off most of you, your radar. That parking lot is going to be designated, in fact, starting now, is designated for first and second time visitors and people with special needs. For example, you have a nursery right here. That mama who's very, very pregnant and trying to get two other little kids out, that would be a special need. And so that parking lot would be there. And so first and second time guests and special needs on this parking lot. We hope to have the new parking lot as soon as possible. It'll have 400 or 500 more spaces. It'll be on the west side of the building. It's not ready yet. And so we know parking's tight, but we do encourage you to kind of help this parking lot have its intended use. Along that same line, we've made a change in what we told you about Easter. We know we sent you a newsletter that said we're having two worship services on Easter and Bible school that morning. Don't believe everything we write to you, okay? Some of it we just make up. But anyhow, no, the problem is that we would love to have this worship center fill twice on Easter morning and just be a tight service. And we could do that. The problem is the parking lot that we need is west of the building is not going to be available in time. Department of Natural Resources, DNR, has to sign off on a particular permit, so therefore we can't bring the dozers in and all those things yet. So parking's the problem. That means the domino becomes this. On Easter morning, we're having three worship services. We're going to have a 7:30 sunrise-type service. It'll be the regular service, and then there'll be a service at 9:15 and a service at 11. And so we just want you to know for that one day. And the reason we're doing that, it has to do with parking. We can't hold Bible school that day because you can't keep both groups, both Bible school and worship, and have enough room. So therefore, on that one Sunday, there's no Bible school and three worship services. Our basic encouragement is to have everybody just kind of move forward one service. Now, that would be our first preference. And we encourage you to do that. If it doesn't work for you, that's fine. Again, just family kinds of things that are going on. I know the flap. We're all sort of learning the flap again as well. Fill that out every week. We'd love for you to do so. If you forget to fill it out by the time the offering comes by, you can drop it off the information center, but we really would like for you to bring an ink pen and sort of get in the habit of that. That's enough of family stuff. Last week, we gave you a little card to fill out. The card that we gave you was one in which you were saying some nice things to people and helping encourage them. I was sick this last week, and so I'll tell you, on a personal level, getting yours, the number I got was very, very encouraging this last week. And Dan or Julie, did I leave that card down there? Sorry. If you ring it, Dan, if you wouldn't mind. This is Dan Hamill, my intern. Dan is a student. Come on up. Dan, no, come on up. Come on up. Dan is single. Dan is a student at the Bible College, and he's been working with us about 6 or 8 months, in particular on I've been warning I'd get revenge over a couple things he's done, so this sounds like a good time to do it. Dan has been working with me about 10 hours a week in the preaching area. He works about 10 hours a week with Rick Bushnell on hospital calling and shut-ins and those things, and he'll be with us for a total of a year. The reason I'm going to hold him here in a second is this card is a card that sort of answers one of his questions. He was asking earlier about the pros and cons of staying as the minister at one congregation a long time, and I've been here a while, and he wanted to know where the strengths and weaknesses, and the answer is seriously, you'll find good things in staying a long time. You can also hurt a congregation by staying a long time. I understand that too. And so we were talking through some of those. But one of the sweet things that comes out of staying a long time is this is a note I got from the chairman of the elders, Bob Nunnally and Terry. And I don't normally read these, but I think it makes sense today. Dear Randy, just wanted to recognize and thank you for your 26 years here at College Heights. There are many things we could say, but we especially would like to comment on the vibrancy we've noticed in your preaching, particularly the last 6 to 8 months. And you've also given us your very best, and the church has grown stronger and deeper because of your ministry. This is not much, but Terry and I would like to give you this gift certificate to Cheddar's. It's great serving with you, Bob and Terry Nunnally. And basically, by staying a while, those kinds of relationships and things sort of naturally happen.
That's interesting. You know, I wasn't planning on sharing this with you, Randy, but I got a note myself last Sunday. I'll get you to my Bible. It's from Bob Nunnally. Here's what he wrote. He said, "Dear Dan, I just wanted to recognize and thank you for your 8 long months of service here at College Heights. There's so many things we could say, but particularly we understand that you've been working with Randy on his sermons. And we've noted some vibrancy in the last 8 months specifically. Thank you very much. We appreciate you giving your best. The church has grown stronger and deeper because of your ministry. And this isn't much, but Terry and I just wanted to give you this gift certificate to Cheddar's. It's great serving with you, Bob and Terry Nunnally." That's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Mine was $30.
Mine too. Now, you may have picked up on this. Some of you are tired from losing that hour of sleep, but Bob didn't write those letters. Julie wrote them last night. But this is our text this morning. If you have your Bibles, Matthew chapter 20, starting in verse 1. If you didn't bring your Bibles, look up on the screens. It'll be there for you. Matthew chapter 20, starting in verse 1. Here's what Jesus says. He says, "For the kingdom of heaven is like a landowner who went out early in the morning to hire men to work in his vineyard." Now, some things we got to understand first is this parable begins with the word "for," and Jesus is making a connection to what came just beforehand. And so look up verse 30 of chapter 19. "But many who are first will be last, and many who are last will be first." So this parable, this story, is really an explanation and a commentary upon that statement. Verse 2, he says, "He went out and he agreed to pay them a denarius for a day for the day and sent them into the vineyard, to his vineyard." Now, a denarius was a Roman coin that represented about what would be the equivalent of a day's worth of money. And so he says, "I'm going to give you a fair price. You go out, you work in my vineyard, you pick some grapes, and I'll take care of you at the end of the day." About the third hour, so we're talking about 9 o'clock in the morning, he went out and saw others standing in the marketplace doing nothing. He told them, "You also go and work in my vineyard, and I will pay you whatever is right." And so they went. He went out again about the 6th hour and about the 9th hour, so 12 o'clock, noon, and 3 o'clock respectively, and he did the same thing. About the 11th hour, 5 o'clock in the afternoon, he went out and found still others standing around. He asked them, "Why have you been standing here all day long doing nothing?" "Because no one has hired us," they answered. So you realize, when it comes to day laborers, they're selected based upon the quality of the labor that they're going to give. The quality of the workers decreases significantly as the time increases. They've been standing in the marketplace. The landers go out, and they want to find the best person to work for them. So these people here who are there at the 11th hour are there because they're 11th hour people, if you know what I'm talking about. These are not the people who are trying to keep their muscles under their tunics because it's just popping out so much. These are the guys who really needed a little bit of extra grace. And the landowner said to them, "You also go and work in my vineyard." When evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to his foreman, "Call the workers and pay them their wages, beginning with the last ones hired and going on to the first." The workers who were hired about the 11th hour came and each received a denarius. So when those came who were hired first, they expected to receive more. So they're thinking at first, this is a great thing. Those people came, they worked for 1 hour, they got a full day's wage. That's what we were supposed to get for working 12 hours. This is going to be awesome. How much do you think he's going to give us? He is in a good mood this afternoon. But each one of them also received a denarius. When they received it, they began to grumble against the landowner. "These men who were hired last worked only 1 hour," they said, "and you've made them equal to us who have borne the burden of the work and the heat of the day?" But he answered one of them, "Friend, I am not being unfair to you. Didn't you agree to work for a denarius? Take your pay and go. I want to give the man who was hired last the same as I gave you. Don't I have the right to do what I want with my own money? Or are you envious?" Literally, do you have evil eyes? "Because I am generous. So the last will be first, and the first will be last."
The context of these two chapters raises a very, very significant question. Who does Jesus choose? Who does Jesus choose to bestow mercy and grace and blessing on? And who will miss out on the things that God gives? What kind of people does he want? We're all familiar with grade school, where you had that hideous time period where you stood like a motley crew while Larry and Brad or whoever it was were told to pick the two teams. And everybody here knows the feeling of having them reach over around your shoulder because they want Rick or somebody else standing behind you, but not you. Everybody here knows that. The thing about this text that makes it incredibly serious is this. This is Jesus Christ, the Son of God. This is God himself standing in front of groups of people, and he is bestowing blessings here, but not here. Bestowing blessings here, but not here. And so the question that begs to be asked today is, are you one of the people that God would bestow blessings on? Are you one of the groups that he wants? The reality of that in this text is that not everyone gets the blessings. Let's go down through them first, quick. When you go down through them, here's what he says. I want you to know there's a divine principle that will always be true. I will choose to be first who you thought would be last, and I will choose to be last who you thought would be first. And then he fleshes it out. For example, Jesus has the opportunity to spend time with the influential and the powerful and those who have significance, those who have maturity in their lives. And Jesus said, "No, I'll take the children." You come to the next issue. You come to the rich young ruler. This is the 19th chapter. The rich young ruler fascinates me. Anything negative you see about him, as far as his character and how he's lived, you have to import it into the text. It's not there. He's the first stable, decent guy that shows up. Everybody who's been following Jesus has had some kind of limp or something that's wrong. This guy looks good. I remember in particular when we helped plant a church in the early 70s in Des Moines. I remember you opened the doors to a new church, and you were just so rejoicing when one stable family finally showed up. One family that actually people worked for a living, and people seemed like they could carry on normal conversations, and they act like they had stability, and you thought, wow, this is really the kind of family God can now bless in this church. Lo and behold, I look at this guy. He's a young ruler whose heart sounds good, and he seems very stable, and it's embarrassing how Jesus treats him. Look at the text. When you go into this chapter, the 19th chapter, verse 21, Jesus answered, "If you want to be perfect, go sell your possessions and give to the poor, and you'll have treasure in heaven. Then follow me." Verse 23, then Jesus said to his disciples, "I tell you the truth, it's hard for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. Again, I tell you, it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a sewing needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven." This man leaves with no particular blessing from God on his life. I come further down. I find two sets of workers. Workers that show up at 6 o'clock in the morning, and they work all day. And at the end of the day, they want to receive what is due them. And guys who show up at 11 o'clock. And I say, where's the grace in this chapter? The answer is the grace isn't given to the guys who show up at 6 o'clock in the morning. The grace is given at 11 o'clock. The guys who show up at 6 and worked all day are not running home and going, hey, he signed over a piece of the vineyard to us. The guys at the end of the day have a story of grace to tell. I go further on in the text, and the mother of James and John, she comes and says, my sons, can they set on the left and right hand? And Jesus goes in and says, I want you to know everything's backwards in this kingdom. That's not where greatness is. You want to know where greatness is? Greatness is being the servant, not being in charge. In your world that you're familiar with, being in charge, and you recognize again, the first to be last and the last to be first. I go further on in the text, and he goes through Jericho, and when he goes through Jericho, there's only two different individuals or groups he spends time with that you're already told about. Blind men, and then a little criminal who's the thief, Zacchaeus. And so I read these two chapters, and in these two chapters, it scares me a little. Because when I cry out, God, would you choose to give me grace? I realize there's some that he does, and with some he doesn't. Now, honestly, which one are you?
One of the things that Bible scholars tell us is when we approach a parable like Matthew chapter 20 or really any parable, one of the most important things that you can do is identify the characters. Who do the characters represent? You have to understand what's being taught and what the association is in order to understand the lesson that Jesus is trying to communicate. And so here's the point. We're dealing with a parable. We're not trying to stand at a distance from this parable and just analyze it and scrutinize it. We're trying to step into this parable and understand how it speaks to our life, the application that Jesus would have us hear and walk away with this morning. And so if we're doing character identification, where are you? And be honest. Take a survey or an inventory of your life, of your past, of the things that you've done, either for or maybe not so much for God. Where are you? Are you one of the guys who got on board with the agenda of God early in life? You're one of the people who sacrificed quite a bit and have borne the burden of labor? Or did you come a little later on the day, maybe at 9 o'clock, maybe noontime, and you say, well, it took me a little while to get on board with what's happening, but I've got with the program pretty quickly. Or maybe you're saying, you know, I'm kind of more towards the end. I'm actually probably, if I'm being honest, I'm the 3 o'clock worker. I'm the 5 o'clock worker. I got there at the 11th hour, and I'm still wrestling with them things. I don't have my hands around everything yet. Where are you at in this text? There's always a danger. Just to warn you, there's always a danger. We try to place ourselves in the text, or really in any story, because of self-association. People have a tendency, you and I do it both, to project ourselves into the characters that we want to be. Think about it. Little girls do this all the time. They hear stories, let's say Cinderella. And there's this poor, sweet, innocent little girl who's mistreated by her family, but who has a pumpkin turn into a carriage, and she meets a prince, and they fall in love, and they live happily ever after. Now, when little girls, 5, 6, 7, hear that story, who do they want to be? Who do they associate themselves with? Well, it's always Cinderella. It's never the wicked stepsisters, no matter how mean or cruel they may be. Same thing true with the little boys, the 8 or 9-year-old, the biggest menace in the entire neighborhood. They read the comic books, and you know they're Superman. You project yourself into the characters that you want to be. It's what psychologists call the fundamental attributive disorder, or the fundamental attributive error, depending on who you talk to. We have the tendency to view ourselves in the light that we want to. And honestly, it affects what we will identify ourselves with in this text today. It affects a lot about the way we think of ourselves. We see ourselves the way we want to. U.S. News and World Report back in 1997 conducted a survey with several thousand people. And they sent out a list, and they said, of this list of celebrities and famous people, which one of them do you think will make it into heaven? Choose all who you think apply, and none who you think won't make it. And so there's some names that you'd expect on the list. Mother Teresa. 79% of everyone who took the survey said Mother Teresa certainly will make it past the pearly gates. St. Peter will give her the thumbs up. Below her, a little bit, Oprah Winfrey, 66%. But you know, she's got this new television show where she's giving away all of her money, so she's probably pretty generous. You can probably count on that, so she probably deserved to be there. Right under her, 65%, Michael Jordan. A lot of basketball fans apparently taking this survey. However, they recognize a qualitative difference because his teammate for a few years, Dennis Rodman, 28%, which is still kind of high if you ask some people. One way or another, what's interesting is that the person who received more votes than anyone else in this entire survey, 87%, was a person who was taking the survey. Of course, everyone who's taking the survey understands themselves as deserving to get into heaven. And that affects the way we read our text today. How do you associate yourself with these characters? The natural inclination, of course, is to see ourselves as the one who have borne the heat of the day and the burden of the labor. You picture yourself in this story, and you've got a sweaty shirt because you've been working in the heat of the day. You picture yourself with calloused hands and with a parched mouth and with a grumbling stomach because of your hard work. And that's the initial assumption, of course, and that's understandable. But just because it's the initial assumption does not necessarily mean it's the accurate one.
We're going to make two observations from the text. Two things that really ought to rock my boat when I study this text and say, God, what do you have to say to Randy Garris when I hold this in my lap? Here's the first. The first there is that it's spiritually dangerous to let your life have even 1 ounce of adequacy or entitlement. It's spiritually dangerous to let your life have even 1 ounce of a sense of adequacy or entitlement. There are two places in the text where there's not one hint of grace being dispersed, not one bit of blessing being coming from God's hand. Two places. In both places, it's these kinds of things. It's the rich young ruler. In the discussion with Jesus said, what is the secret to spiritual things? And what are you doing? And how have you been living? And the answer that the man gives back is, I've kept and I've done in my whole life. And he begins to give the litany of what he would consider his credentials. They're not bad credentials, though, folks. They're good credentials when you look at them. And yet, the man who gives his credentials and says, this is my work, this is my life, this is what I present, that man leaves the presence of God with zero additional grace. No blessing given to him. It rolls you back. The other one, obviously, is the 6 o'clock in the morning workers. The ones who bore the heat of the day. The ones who said all day long, we work for what we contracted you with. And at the end of the day, they're the ones who are offended. They are offended because our work stands for us. These guys work. The guy that shows at 5 in the afternoon, his work doesn't stand for him. Our work stands for us. And they are offended at what he does. Grace is a really easy word to sort of pitch around unless you think about it. There's a scandal to grace. It has an edge to it. The scandal of grace is when you think your work ought to stand. Everybody here remembers college somewhere. That you studied all night, you wrote the paper all night, you drank coffee all night, you typed like crazy, and you came running into class, and you had made it. You'd pulled it off. Here it is. All page and a half. I mean, I don't know what it is. All 17 pages. And you bring the 17 pages in, and you bring it in, and you sit down. Because you know the rest of the nature of this class. And sure enough, a bunch of whiners come dragging in. And they say to the professor all kinds of things like, we didn't know and we couldn't find and the library didn't have and wow, this didn't work and can we have till the weekend to get it done? And you're sitting there going, no, don't you dare let them have over the weekend to get it done. And he says benevolently, oh, keep your papers and turn them in on Monday. And you're ticked. Because the essence of the point is, I've done mine. I've got what it takes. Look, this isn't fair. The scandal of grace is what's so offensive about Jesus. Don't kid yourself. Not everyone is going to like Jesus. Jesus is going to look like an idiot in the eyes of lots of people. Oh, maybe the issue of children and self-discipline about papers and school ought to set aside for a second. But Jesus says this clearly in text. If you ever want grace from God, you better understand your work can never, never, ever speak for you. Don't you dare ever want your life to stand on its own. In fact, Jesus will begin his very ministry about the kingdom with these set of words. They're so backwards. We know them. We hear them as familiar, but they're backwards. Jesus said, blessed are the poor in spirit. You want to know who's going to be blessed? Do you want to know who's going to receive in this kingdom? Do you want to know whose life is going to be absolutely enriched? Blessed are the poor in spirit. And blessed are those who mourn. And blessed are the meek. Because those are the precursors for grace. And those are the precursors for everything God will dispense. Spiritual arrogance is what you find. It's not offensive enough in the text to drive us crazy. It looks rather normal. You came at 6 in the morning, you worked all day. Well, of course you ought to get what you worked for. You're a good man, and you've been keeping the law. Well, of course you've done well. We don't recognize what God detests, which is spiritual arrogance. The arrogance that says, God, I guess you can judge me on my works or my life. I don't know that Dan knew entirely why, early on, why I wanted him up here on the stage, even visually. What you see right here is in itself the battle. The preacher and the intern. I started in that chair a lot of years ago. Back when you're supposed to be wet behind the ears and when you're not supposed to know how to do some stuff and how you give your life to the Lord and you say, God, use me, and you say, but I don't know how, I don't know these things. But over the years, you'll move. And as the years go by, you can stop being the intern. You can become the preacher. And you can know in your own mind the number of hours you've spent with people. And you can point to the bruises and the scars. And you can tell of your years of service, your lack of sleep. And there comes a scary time that you're reading text that you realize everybody struggles with the paradigm of which am I? The preacher or the intern? And when I read the text, the only ones who get grace and blessings are the interns. Everybody who says, I'll let my life and my works speak for me, ended up empty-handed. You have the delusional concept that begins to slip in, spiritual arrogance, that somehow my life is capable of speaking. Matthew records it in subtle ways. Luke doesn't record it as subtly. It's the same episode, same place, same spot in Jesus' ministry. Matthew just tells you the story. These guys are blessed, these guys weren't. Luke tells you why. In Luke, the 18th chapter, the 9th verse, here's what it says. And to some who were confident of their own righteousness, and they looked down on everyone else, Jesus told this parable. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee, the other tax collector. And the Pharisee stood up and prayed about himself. God, I thank you. I'm not like other men, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, even like this tax collector or intern. I fast twice a week. I get a tenth. I give a tenth of all I get. But the tax collector stood at a distance. He would not even look up to heaven, but he beat his breast and said, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. And I tell you, this man, rather than the other, went home justified before God, for everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. It is the very close of Jesus' ministry. He is headed to Jerusalem. His death is soon to follow. And in every interchange, he clearly says, it is incredibly dangerous to be spiritually arrogant. I choose to pour out my blessings on those who don't have an ounce of it. I ask you the question, are you one of the ones who the Lord would bless?
Now, the second observation in this text that we want to make that speaks to us is that God is a God who delights in giving grace. You see, this landowner wasn't obligated, didn't have to give a full day's wage to people who worked 1 or 3 or 6 hours. He didn't have to. When he made the verbal contract with them, he didn't have a slip of tongue and say, I'll give you full, I mean, he gave them more than they deserved, way more than they had earned, because he wanted to bless them out of the kindness of his heart. And it's bad economics, and it doesn't make sense. And for those who worked hard, worked all day long, who thought they deserved something, they had earned their own, honestly, it's just offensive. But even though it doesn't make a lot of sense, one way or another, this is who God has revealed himself to be. I was reading just this week about a conference that took place several decades ago, in Britain. And they gathered together experts and scholars from all over the world, and they discussed this question. This is the question they threw out to one another. What, if any, doctrine or belief is unique and distinctive to Christianity? What does Christianity offer that no other religion on the earth does? And is there anything even unique about the faith of Jesus? And they threw out the incarnation. They said, well, I mean, we got a God who becomes man. Is that unique? And people said, no. I mean, if you look at other religions, they have a form of that. It's not the exact same story, of course, but you can see that elsewhere. Well, how about the resurrection? How about Jesus rising from the dead? And they said, well, once again, not the exact same story. Resurrection is used differently, but there's other stories of people coming back to life. And so they went on and on. There was banter. There was discussion. Before too long, C.S. Lewis enters into the room, and he says, what's everything about? And they said, we're discussing Christianity's unique contribution to the world religions. He said, what is it? And C.S. Lewis said, oh, that's easy. It's grace. It's grace. The notion that God would freely offer his love and his acceptance and his favor to those who have done nothing to deserve it is unique to Christianity. And it's honestly, it's such a silly notion that no other religion, no other people even comprehended it. That God would, no strings attached, just because he wanted to, offer his love and his acceptance to people who have deserved just the opposite. That doesn't make any sense. And so people of other religious persuasions have tried to earn their way to have a status and a standing before God. The Buddhists have an eightfold plan that they have to subscribe to. The Hindus, well, they have their doctrine of karma and reincarnation so that everything is made right in the end. You have the Jews, and they have their covenant with 613 laws that are to be kept to the T. And of course you have the Muslims, who have their five pillars of Islam that they have to hold to dogmatically and rigidly. And why do they do these things? But to earn God's favor, to earn their wages from the Creator God. And only in Christianity do you see a God who willingly, and not just willingly, but a God who delights in giving grace and giving his love to people who have deserved just the opposite. It is a notion that is so far-fetched and so nonsensical that other religions didn't even come up with it. It's pretty unique. And while it is offensive to some, and while it's confusing to others, it is not only our salvation, it is the way that the grace of God and the way of Jesus and the economy of the kingdom functions. It is the linchpin, it is the fulcrum on which everything rides, the grace of God. We're not in a contract where we get what we deserved. We don't work for an employer. We live as a child of the Father. Isaiah 55 says, "For your thoughts are not my thoughts, neither are your ways my ways. For as high as the heavens are above the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts higher than your thoughts." So many times when this passage is read and when it's quoted, people think of this huge, mighty, distant, powerful God who looks up from the heavens down at the little earth with his secret playbook of how eternity is going to work itself out. But you read the context, and it doesn't have a single thing at all to do with that. The context isn't about God's power or his remoteness or his secret plans. The context is about God's desire to forgive and offer love and grace to people who don't deserve it. And other people will say, why in the world would you do that? And God says, you may not be able to understand, but this is who I am. I am the God who delights to give grace. When we come to this text, none of us are invited to see ourselves as people who deserve something from God. There's not a one of us in this room who deserves a single ounce of the grace of God. And yet it's because of who he has decided to lavish it on us with all wisdom and understanding. And that is good news, because we do not worship and honor a God who treats us as we deserve, but we honor and worship and praise a God who treats us as his grace has provoked him to. We worship and honor a God who doesn't treat us based upon who we are, what we have done, but based upon who he is and what he has done. We worship and honor a God who delights in giving grace.
So we are nothing but 11 o'clock workers, who some of us just simply started when we were a little younger, but 11 o'clock workers. There are people in this room that you have so many skeletons in your closet that you can't imagine God would ever want you. And every single page shouts, grace, grace. There's some in this room who the battle is somehow the background. Somewhere along the line, you slipped from becoming the intern to the preacher, and you forgot the 11 o'clock worker. The invitation hymn is an invitation we're going to invite you. If you're not a believer in Jesus Christ, if you've never accepted grace, you need to. You need to. There'll be people down here, ministers, elders out in the aisles. They would love to visit with you. This morning, some of you, I think, need to simply say, this issue is, I've got to be telling grace. I've got to be telling it. I've got to be proclaiming it. I've got to spread this. I know nothing else better than this story, and you've got to be telling it. But this morning, we read chapters 19 and 20 in the book of Matthew, and I say again, God, who do you choose? And God says, I choose those who understand they need me. Would that be the cry of your heart as we stand and we sing?